we go ahead and convene the meeting, and the regular and supplemental meetings are called to order, and the supplemental meeting is recessed. First item on our agenda, let's take a moment of silence for those, I think it's page 5 of the book, for those police and fire officers who passed away during February. So let's just take a moment of silence. Okay, that's good. Next is the consent agenda, and the first item is the approval of the minutes of our February 11th meeting. They're in your book. Everybody's had a chance to look at them. Are there any comments or corrections or changes anybody suggesting?
Armando, motion to approve.
Okay, thank you, Armando. Do we have a second?
Alan, second.
Alan, second. Thank you. All in favor?
Aye. Okay.
Any opposed? Okay, great. We will take that as the unanimous approval of those that are here. The next item is the approval of the consent agenda. Kelly, again, each month I'll just ask you, is there anything unusual there that we need to be aware of?
Good morning, everyone. No, there's nothing unusual on this consent agenda.
Okay, then I'll entertain a motion to approve.
This is Ken. Move approval.
Okay, Ken, thank you. Do we get a second?
Armando.
Okay. And just easy. Anybody oppose adopting the consent agenda? Hearing none, it passes. And now we go to anybody in the public comment area, anybody who's outside of the board, want to address the board at this stage?
Press 5-star. On your phone, it'll raise your hand. I'll unmute you. I'm not seeing anyone.
Okay, good. Okay, we'll move on this point. Okay, we'll go to our regular items. The first item on the agenda is the update on the peer compensation review. Kelly, do you want to introduce this and then introduce Lori?
Yes, thank you. Lori, are you on the phone?
Yes, I am.
Okay, great. Just let me do a little brief intro, and then I will turn it over to you. John, if you could go to the next page, that would be great. So as the board recalls, we've been working on this peer compensation review for quite some time, and the board didn't simply want a salary study. They also wanted to look at total compensation. So we reached out to Lori Messer at Logic Compensation Group last year, and she developed a basically a custom survey for us to look at not only salaries, but also benefits from other organizations. In addition to that, we've also incorporated some national data. We did have some challenges, as Lori will talk to, of getting organizations to participate with us, but with some pressure and some open records requests, we were able to get more data, but that was part of the reason for the delay here. So you have Lori's study. You received it late yesterday. We apologize for the lateness in it, but we were fine-tuning it, and we also had Steve taking a look at it and wanted to make sure he had a chance to do that. So I just wanted to say, you know, the way this is organized, and Lori will go over this, is she's going to talk a little bit about her background, you know, their organization's background, their process, and then talk about the results. She's going to start with benefits and then go into salaries. The reason for that really is we think the salaries will probably get the most interest, and we didn't want the whole presentation to kind of get taken up with that and not get to the rest of it. So she has a lot of slides. We'll probably be moving pretty quickly. We'll like, you know, of course, wants to answer your questions, but we'll have to, you know, be cognizant of time. So with that, Lori, I will turn it over to you.
Great. Thank you, Kelly. Okay, if we can move to the next slide. As Kelly mentioned, we have a lot of things to discuss today. Tell you a little bit about our firm, go over the overall methodology, the process, key activities that we performed. The salary information actually is not in the middle of the presentation, but it's been slotted down towards the back of the presentation, and then we will give you some recommendations based on the information that we collected through the survey process. All right, so let's talk a little bit about our firm on the next slide. Our team has worked together for a minimum of 7 years. Some of us have worked together for actually 20 years. All of the team has more than 15 years of professional level experience in performing classification and compensation work. The key thing about our firm is we limit the number of organizations, number of clients that we work with simultaneously, because we feel it's important to be able to give each of our clients, you know, quick response time and get to know their organizations. Now, there are a sampling to the right of clients that we have worked with, a couple of pension funds, El Paso Police and Fire, as well as the Texas Municipal Retirement System. I've worked with both of those firms in my prior life with another consulting firm, as well as now for about, at least probably close to 7 years, have done several studies for TMRS, and then we are also working with the Austin Firefighter Retirement System. So let's talk a little bit about our team on the next slide. There's myself, of course. I'm the managing director of the firm. I have 30 years of experience doing this type of work, 7 years as a West Coast office principal for Gallagher Benefit Services. Some of you may have heard of them. And then additional time spent in high-tech engineering distribution healthcare industries. Bruce has over 35 years of experience. He's our technical advisor. He's owned his own consulting firm and been a managing director at Gallagher Benefit Services. Annette Hafer is our principal consultant. She has been doing class and comp work for 25 years, also worked with her with Fox Lawson and Gallagher Benefit Services. And Nicole Arco is our consultant. She has over 20 years of experience, 7 with Gallagher Benefit Services, and 15 in a variety of other industries. So that's a little bit about our firm. We've been doing this for a long time, so just wanted to let you know a little bit about us. So moving on to the study objectives. There were 3 primary objectives. We wanted to understand the market and how DPFP compares from a level of competitiveness from not only base pay, but also total compensation. We also wanted to identify if there were any pay alternatives that don't add to base but still allow for recognition and rewards of performance. And then we wanted to identify what that fiscal impact would be. One of the things that I should have mentioned at the onset, and I think Kelly touched on this, if you have questions as we're going through, I do have the Q&A screen up. Feel free to interrupt me. I know I sometimes have a tendency to talk fast because we've got a lot of information, but please feel free to stop me if you have a question. All right, great. So let's start with the study initiation on the next page. In order to kick off the study, we met with Kelly and her team to collect information, things like org charts, employee census, job descriptions, benefits information. We also interviewed managers and supervisors, executive team, to get an understanding of the work that is performed there at the pension fund. We talked about comparator organizations, and I'm going to go into more detail and just giving you a high level. Here's what we talked about. We talked about comparator organizations. What should we be looking for? What information should we collect in the study in order to get the information that we wanted to assess? And we talked about metrics for assessing competitive position. Should they be actual salaries? Should they be salary ranges? Should it be the median, average, 60th percentile, et cetera? So moving on to, let's talk a little bit about the comparator organizations. When looking at comparator organizations, there were four metrics that we wanted to take a look at in order to ensure that we were comparing organizations of similar character to DPFP. So one of the first things that we looked at was geographic location. There was a preference for Texas organizations. However, I didn't feel that there were enough organizations that met the other criteria within Texas. So therefore, we went outside of Texas in order to ensure that we would collect sufficient data, do the analysis, and make recommendations. The second item was the size of the investment portfolio. We have standard guidelines in determining what's a good comparator. And typically, we want to fall within the not less than half your size, not greater than twice your size. And that has to do with the investment portfolio. There were are exceptions that exist because it was very challenging to get all of the criteria to fall within those parameters. And I will talk about those exceptions in the presentation. We also wanted to look at what is the investment management structure externally managed. The reason we wanted to focus on externally managed is because in the investment positions, when you're internally managed, the compensation structure is significantly different than an externally managed organization. And then we looked at size of membership. Again, no less than half, no greater than twice, but again, exceptions do exist. Since we couldn't meet all of the criteria in all four areas, it was a combination to come up with a sufficient number of comparator organizations. So if we go to the next slide, we asked 16 organizations to participate in the survey. We did get 8 organizations that without a problem went ahead and completed and returned to us. For the remaining 8, we did do open records requests, and they are listed here. With the open records requests, we did not get complete information, and we tried to fill in the holes where we couldn't, where they didn't complete that or share that information with us, and some just said they weren't going to share it with us because it was employee data. We did not get any data from 2 of them. Kansas City, we could have gotten it, but there was a timing issue, we still wouldn't have it today. And Oklahoma did not respond to our request at all. So we got a good sampling of data, 14 organizations, which is a good sampling for the study. All right, so let's talk about the demographics of those survey participants on the next slide. Here I showed you DPFP's number of members, the size of the investment portfolio, and we also asked about some staffing issues. As you can see, the market median of all of the participants, as well as the market average, were extremely close to the number of members and the size of the investment portfolio of DPFP. Again, there are exceptions that exist to those numbers, but for the most part, we were right on target with where we wanted to be. Okay? All right, so moving on to the next slide. When we collected the data from these organizations, as you notice, they were in different states than Texas, as well as different cities within Texas. So one of the things that we do, we want to compare apples to apples. So we need to normalize the data, the salary data that we get from other geographic locations to make sure that we normalize the data because there are different costs of labor across the country. So our base city was Dallas, and these adjustment factors that you see here on the right for each of the cities in which the other pension funds reside, we used that factor and applied it to the salary data which then normalized it to the cost of labor in Dallas. So to show you an example of what that looks like, if we go to the next slide, here, you know, Dallas is our base city. The geographic factor is 100%. Then El Paso has a lower cost of labor than Dallas, so we needed to increase those reported salaries by 113.6%. Seattle has a higher cost of labor than Dallas, so we had to take their data and multiply it times 91.9% in order to normalize the data. And it just shows what those adjusted salaries would look like over on the far right. Okay. Moving on to the market survey, key activities we did here, we prepared and distributed a custom survey to the comparator organizations. Once we got all of that data back, it was outside of the scope, but was requested that we gather market data from some published survey sources. So we gathered data from Perlmeyer, the Economic Research Institute, and Comp Data in order to supplement the data from the custom survey. Once we sent out the custom survey to the comparator organizations, we did do follow-ups to encourage participation, obtain clarification once we got their surveys back when we had questionable responses. Then we analyzed the data, performed internal quality control checks. And when we analyzed the data, we used a three-way assessment. We looked at short-term compensation, we looked at benefit spend, and then we looked at total compensation. Okay, so you're going to see the results of all of that, our analysis, throughout this presentation. All right, so now let's talk about the process on the following slide. When we sent out the survey, we asked organizations, don't just match your jobs to the survey jobs on title alone. We want you to read the descriptions, and we are looking for jobs that are a 70% match to the summary descriptions. The reason for that, the 70% threshold is a standard compensation threshold for benchmarking jobs and making comparisons. No job is exactly like DPFP. In the market, so therefore we know if we were looking for 100% matches, we wouldn't get any very much data back. So that is why we chose 70%. Again, it's just a standard metric in comp studies. Once we got the data, as I mentioned, we validated them. We reviewed the job matches. We reviewed the FLSA designation. We did an outlier analysis to identify any data that was between 1.5 and 2 standard deviations from the mean of the data we did collect. And we also reviewed comparator organization job descriptions to ensure appropriate matching. Any matches that were identified as less than a 70% match were excluded from the data analysis, as well as any extreme outliers of data. Typically, when we see an extreme outlier of data, that means that there's a problem with the matching as well. For pensions that are part of a larger city organization, in other words, they have shared services, their HR, they use the larger organization's HR department or the finance department. We did not include those shared service positions in the survey results. Okay, so as I mentioned, as part of the survey, we not only surveyed salaries, we also surveyed some compensation and benefits data. So if we go to the next slide, one of the things we asked about is, do you utilize a formal salary range? Of those organizations surveyed, 7 of them have formal salary ranges. 2 did not have salary ranges, and 1 of the organizations used a combination of salary ranges and flat rate jobs. They just have a flat rate for the jobs, the market rate. And 5 of them did not report. So where we found where there were either a combination of ranges or no salary ranges, typically that's in the executive ranks, like the executive director, perhaps the CIO, they may have flat rate jobs, but for the majority of other staff positions, we did see ranges. All right. So we felt in looking at that that DPFP is lagging the market with just with not having established salary ranges. Now, there are pros and cons to using salary ranges, and if we go to the next slide, I cover those briefly. Some of the cons is that it can appear to be limiting. The reality is there's not unlimited earnings for every job within the market. Also, another con is that managing salary structures, there's a time and resource commitment that goes along with that because you want to make sure that they stay updated. It's not a one and done type of deal. There are more pros than cons to having established salary ranges. It helps the organization in making salary decisions. Where do you fall within that range? It affords the same salary opportunity for individuals who are doing the same work. It is a tool for managing salary dollars. It also aids in budgeting. Where do people fall within the range? What sort of increases are you going to give? And it also provides transparency and clarifies the value of pay for the type of work that's being performed. All right. Moving on to the next slide, we looked at paid leave programs. We found that we asked, do you have a paid time off program or do you have a traditional leave program that has vacation and sick leave as separate banks? And the majority of organizations like DPFP have a traditional leave program. Then we looked at what are the components of that leave program on the following slide. So we looked at what's the annual accrual for vacation and what's the maximum allowable carryover. And we found that the organization is on par with that. Now, it's important to note at the higher levels, not everybody is going to have 25 plus years of service. So even though DPFP has 25 days and the market only has 21, that was not a big concern. When we looked at the carryover, it was pretty comparable there as well. Okay. Moving to the next slide, we look at sick leave. We also found DPFP to be on par there as well. The accrual, how much you can accrue, it's 10 days a year, same in the market. The maximum allowable carryover is not as big of a factor. How much you can carry over really is not as large of a factor as when we go to the next slide and talk about what's the payout, because sick leave is not a common thing that is always paid out. In this case, the market pays out 78 days and the fund pays out 90. And it's not always a dollar for dollar payout either. And there was no real consistency of how people paid out. Some paid out 25% of your balance. Others, was dependent upon your years of service and a sliding scale as to how much you got paid out. So there was a lot of variability there on sick leave payout. With vacation leave payout, it's dollar for dollar, whatever you're making now is consistent across the market with the number of days that you could be paid out. And often this payout was aligned very closely with the maximum that you can accrue in your vacation bank. So DPFP was on par there. So the next slide just says, when we look at all of your paid leave programs collectively, what is your maximum accrual? What is the carryover? What is the payout? We found for both sick and vacation that DPFP was on par with the market. The next thing that we looked at was the retirement programs. When we looked at the retirement programs, something really stood out. The majority of organizations surveyed do participate in Social Security. In addition to Social Security, they also have defined benefit plans for retirement. So we found that because DPFP does not participate in Social Security and they do not have a defined benefit plan, we felt that they were lagging, that you're lagging in this area. We did look at other types of retirement programs as well on the next slide. DPFP has a mandatory defined contribution plan, and there were two other market comparators that did have that type of a program. However, one of those organizations, in addition to the mandatory defined contribution program, also participated in Social Security. Of those two organizations that have the mandatory defined contribution plan, the contributions were 25%, employer contributions were 25% and 15%, both of which are greater than the 12% contribution provided by DPFP. Also, like DPFP, nine of the organizations do offer voluntary defined contribution plans, such as 457, which was the most common in the marketplace. One of the organizations had a 401k. The majority of those organizations do not provide employer match. Only two of them did, and one of the organizations gave a 1% match. The other just did a flat $1,500 a year annual contribution. Now, with those contributions, those matching contributions, the expectation was that you had to, the employee had to be participating in those plans in order to get a match. So when we look collectively at the retirement program, our assessment was that DPFP is lagging the market collectively in all areas there.
I have a question.
From contribution percentage. Yes. Uh-huh. Go ahead.
Okay. So of the, I'm assuming one that also participated in Social Security was one of the 25% or 15%. Mandatory contribution plan. Do you know which one of those participated in Social Security?
I believe, let me see, I have my, I can tell you. I have the benefits stuff up in case. When we looked at that, it was mandatory defined. It was, yes, Austin Firefighters. The Austin Firefighter Relief and Retirement System.
And that was a 25 or 15% mandatory contribution plan?
25%.
Oh, interesting. Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Another quick question. Mm-hmm. Of all the pension funds that you looked at that have defined benefit, were you able to kind of dissect those plans and see how they did their defined benefit? In other words, did they use an outside organization? Did they use their own organization, or did they run it totally themselves?
That was not a question on the survey, but some of them did indicate that they are part of a larger plan. Like, for example, if they're a division of a city, they would be participating in that larger city plan. But we did not ask that question.
Isn't that the case in a lot of this analysis, that these other funds are part of the city or a subdivision of the city where we're a separate unit, which would have a major difference on size and of coverage in a lot of areas?
I would say it's probably because we didn't ask that question. Here's the names. I do have the names. Some of them have their own. I would say it's probably at least the ones that did report the name that they're participating in, 1, 2, 3 for certain had their own, but not a lot of people reported what the name were. So I see of those that did report the name of their plan, 3 are independent and 3 are part of a city plan. So only 6 actually reported their name of their funds that they participate in. Any other questions on that? Okay.
Hey, Ken, on that, I can get you the information relative to the Texas plans and get you that after the meeting. That's pretty simple to do. Just the out-of-state ones I might have a little harder time tracking down, but I can try to do that.
Okay, thanks.
Great. So then we move on to the next slide, which is where we took a look at health and welfare. So one of the things, you know, there's varying levels of coverage, but in order, you know, employers always have the employee level. So we focused our analysis on that to scale down a little bit what we were looking at. So a lot of the organizations that we surveyed are part of a larger organization, and their health, they participate in city-sponsored health plans. Now, the one thing about that is because those cities are larger cities, they have multiple offerings. They might have a PPO, an HMO, and a high deductible plan. So because DPFP is a smaller organization, they have one health plan, the high deductible health plan. We're focusing our analysis of the health and welfare program on those high deductible health plans. And a lot of organizations did offer the high deductible health plan as well. Eight of the comparator organizations indicated that they do offer a high deductible health plan, and seven do provide for employer contributions to a health savings account. One of the other things that DPFP has is a health reimbursement account. We did not specifically ask other organizations if they had health reimbursement accounts. We did ask, you know, please share with us any other health related benefit programs that you do have, and we did not get any responses from that. But it's important to note that DPFP does have a health reimbursement account, and it provides for an employer paid benefit of up to $3,750 for employee only and $7,500 for family coverage to lower the overall out-of-pocket costs to employees. Okay. Over a three-year period, we pulled the records back 3 years. Approximately 25% of the employees did have claims that fell into the HRA coverage area. And the average employer spend over those 3 years was approximately $24,500 per year. Okay. We want to point that out because even though like only 25% of employees are using it, it is an employer spend, and we are focusing here on the employer spend.
So just to clarify a little bit on that, and I don't want to get into a whole conversation on it, a lot of people aren't familiar with an HRA. They get it confused with an FSA, a flexible spending account, and it's not that. And those are what I think probably a lot of you are familiar with. What the HRA does, as Lori explained, it does two things. It allows the system to buy less insurance coverage. So the actual premiums that we're paying on the employer and the employer and the employee side, basically, the coverage for our insurance, which is currently All Savers, kicks in at that $6,750 level. And the HRA covers all claims that happen between $3,000 and the $6,750. So instead of buying insurance that goes all the way down to that $3,000 level, which is more expensive for both the employer and employee, the analysis has been, well, not everybody's going to hit that $3,000 level, so you're better off doing this way. That's why it's layered. It's confusing, and we can do a whole separate agenda item on that if you want more information.
Great. Thank you, Kelly. Okay, moving on to the next page here, we're going to take a look at the health and welfare programs a little bit more in depth. One of the things that we looked at off to the left is what is the average annual health and welfare employer spend, again, for employee-only coverage. Now, when we talk about health and welfare employer spend, what I'm looking at, and there's a footnote at the bottom, this includes information specifically to the high deductible plan for medical, looks at dental premiums, looks at vision premiums, and also takes into account annual health savings account employer contributions. So So when we look at the average annual spend for employee only on health and welfare, the market is covering paying $7,541 annually. $6,584 of that is for the health and welfare premiums. $957 is the HSA contribution on average. The fund is paying a total of $6,571 annually. The health premium amount is $5,071. And the HSA contribution is $1,500. And again, this is for employee-only level coverage. Kelly touched on the deductibles. And over on the far right, we show for the market the health insurance high deductible health plan averages in the market for deductibles and out-of-pockets for all levels of coverage. The deductibles are just beneath what the deductibles are for the funds, taking into consideration the health reimbursement account contributions, if applicable. Again, not everybody needs that, but these deductibles are reduced by those amounts. And it's $3,750 at the employee-only level and $7,500 for employee-plus coverage. Then when we look at out-of-pocket maximums, this is where we see the biggest difference, the market out-of-pocket are significantly higher than the fund. However, keep in mind, we did not receive specific information from the survey respondents regarding whether or not they had an HRA that could potentially reduce those. So that is just based on what they reported, right? Okay. So here you're leading the market in that this is great. Your overall cost from an employer perspective is lower. Your overall out-of-pockets are lower. So from this lens, we see that the fund is leading the market. The next slide takes a look at the average monthly medical premiums, again, for the high-deductible health plan. I think it's important to note here, when we look at what the market premiums are, this is specific to the targeted comparator organizations that we surveyed. Okay. So if you go out in the market, and what we tend to find is in the public sector arena, we find that public sector organizations are a little bit more paternalistic, so we tend to see greater contributions to the health plan premiums than you might see in the private sector. So when you look over to the right-hand side of this chart, we see that for employee-only coverage in the market, the average based on the comparator organizations we surveyed, the employer is paying 94% of the premium while the employee is paying 6%. And so all through here at all levels of coverage, we found a significant difference between the fund's premium share compared to the market premium share, again, based on this group of employers that we surveyed. So what we indicated here is that we felt that the fund is lagging the market with respect to the overall premium shares. Premiums are on average 28% less when you look at all levels of coverage than the market, the employer spend on medical premiums is 20% less than the market average, but the total premium is only 3% less. Again, I already talked about the premium share. One of the things that stood out, when we look at actual, what are employees paying for this coverage, at the fund, employees contribute $165 a month for employee-only level coverage compared to the market average employee contribution, which we found to be $35 a month on average. So there was a significant difference that we saw there. Okay. So if we move on to the next slide, I know this is like a lot to take in. So the largest portion of health and welfare assessment that we did is attributable to the health insurance premiums. That is usually, that's the highest cost of all of those factors. Dental is nominal, vision is nominal. When we look at the health insurance premium, we found that, you know, we focused on the employer spend. We did not focus on plan design elements. That was not part of the scope of the study. We did look at deductibles and out-of-pocket, but that is basically where it ended. And what we found is that while the fund's average premium cost for all levels of coverage combined is competitive with the market, it falls within 10%. It's just 8.2% higher than the market average. The premium share is significantly lower than the market on aggregate for all levels of coverage by 21%. When we look at employee-only coverage, it's 24% lower. Okay. So the average contribution to health insurance premiums for all levels of coverage combined is 65%. But when we compare the employer average contributions to the market is covering 86% of the total premiums. So collectively looking at that and spend, we felt that the fund was lagging the market and primarily due to the premium share for all levels of coverage. Okay. Now, there's a lot of ways to look at this, and plan design plays a huge role in what overall costs are. And Kelly touched on that a bit. You know, you're getting a better rate because of the health reimbursement account. But like I said, what really popped out was the premium shares and the amount that employees are paying. Okay. All right. Looking at other benefit offerings. So when we look here at the other benefits offerings, we did ask about life insurance. We found you'd be on par with life insurance. One organization, the majority of them did indicate that they offer employer-paid life insurance, basic life insurance, with the majority of organizations offering time-based pay. There, we also looked at long-term care coverage. Only one other organization offered that, and their level of coverage was $2,000 a month compared to the fund's $3,000 a month of coverage. And we also looked at disability coverage, long-term and short-term, and six of the nine organizations that did respond to that question do offer employer-paid short-term disability coverage with an average level of salary replacement at 66%, very comparable to the fund. Seven of the nine organizations offer employer-paid long-term disability, just like the fund with a salary replacement of 60%. So when we looked at these other benefit offerings, we did feel that the fund was on par with the market. All right. Okay, now moving along into the salary data portion of the study. When we looked at the data collectively, all jobs combined, and we also separated out the jobs into two separate groups, the executive management group, which is your most senior staff at the fund, and the staff level positions. The reason we decided to group them, not an uncommon practice to do, but we did see significant disparities in how the two groups compared to market. And I'm going to share that with you in a couple of slides to show how it looked at each level. Specific items to note about the overall results is that the results show an aggregate comparison against the market by group. The comparison of individual jobs, while we show the aggregate data, we did not go down to the individual job level because many of the jobs are single incumbent roles, and the purposes of this presentation, we wanted to show it as aggregates. So individual job comparisons may vary. They do vary from the overall aggregate results. All right. The data we're going to show you is representative of current pay as of November 1st, plus when we looked at incentives and bonuses, those were actuals paid in 2019. Because 2020 was not complete, we didn't have full data, and we wanted to look at a full year's of data. Okay. Next slide. The methodology that we utilized in continuing. Salary comparisons were made when both the fund and the market had reportable data. So there had to be data in both groups in order to make the overall comparison. An example is the fund has a role, Deputy Chief Investment Officer, but when we went out and looked at the market, we did not get sufficient data to do analysis and make conclusions on that. Therefore, that information was excluded from the aggregate comparison. And then we looked to see, you know, how far above or below the market is the fund. Total compensation comparisons include average employer spend in the following benefit areas. Health and welfare, those are premiums paid for medical, dental, and vision, as well as HSA contributions for employee-only coverage. Retirement, we looked at contributions to Social Security, pension funds, and mandatory defined contribution plans. And then we also took into consideration legally required benefits, such as FICA and federal and state unemployment insurance. So if you don't participate in Social Security, you still have to pay into Medicare. So that's why we have this included here as well. All right. So what does it look like? Moving on to the next slide. This shows the summary of the analysis results. And basically, these results are meant to serve as an indicator of how the fund compares to the market and is specific to a point in time. You know, pay is always evolving. It's not stagnant, so it's constantly changing. So we want to point out again, just to remind you, that this is a look at a point in time. We did vet the data thoroughly, utilizing all available resources at our disposal. But errors and omissions can occur based on the reliance of data from received from participating organizations. So we do want to clarify that. We did go back. We looked at job descriptions. We looked at websites. We made phone calls. But, you know, the reality is that errors and omissions can happen from the comparator organizations. So this is meant to give us a sense of where does the fund stand. So as we look at this, the first section is all employees. And what we looked at is we looked at comparisons for short-term cash, which is the base salary plus any bonuses and incentives. And I do want to make a comment about the bonus and incentive piece. There are very few organizations that did provide for bonuses and incentives. So if you provided for it, it was included. If you did not, it was also, that's a zero, right? So collectively, it did not make that large of a difference. When I looked at just salary alone, if you look at the market median with salary and bonus incentive, the fund is leading the market by 21.5%. If we solely looked at base pay alone, this metric came 20%, so there was like a 1.5% difference. The market average for all employees was 19.4%. When we looked at total cash, this is where, you know, things changed quite a bit. When we looked at total cash comparisons at the median, and you would include any bonus or incentive here because that's part of the total cash, all employees lead the market median by 6.7%. So it really narrowed the gap here when we took into consideration the benefits piece. The market average was that the fund is leading by 7.2%. And below that is where we break out the two groups of executive management, which is the most senior staff, and then the remainder of the staff. And what we found here on the short-term cash side is that in the executive management ranks at the median of the market, the fund is leading by 39.3%, and staff positions are leading by 8.7%. This is 8.7 considered competitive. We have metrics that we use. Anything greater than 15% is considered significantly misaligned, but I did not use those terminologies here because we don't have salary ranges to make our comparisons. We're comparing actual salaries against actual salaries. But at the staff level, it's competitive. When we looked at market averages, executive management was leading the market by 36% and staff was leading by 7.3%. When we look at total compensation, narrowed the gap here for executive management. Executive management is leading by 22.1% at the median and 23.2% at the average. But when we look at the staff positions, this is where now they are lagging the market by 4% at the median and 3.8% at the market average. Even though it's a lag, that 3.8% and 4%, that's considered highly competitive. Okay? So a negative doesn't necessarily mean bad. It just means that you're slightly below. Anything within 5% plus or minus, we consider highly competitive.
Do you have any
okay.
I have a question. I had a question here.
Yes.
Let me ask mine first, and I'll let you go then, please. Do you have a sense of how many of these plans actually have bonus plans but didn't report them, or you just no way of knowing that?
Well, we did know of one organization that did have bonuses but did not report them, and we were unable to obtain that data. Now, there could be more. But it wasn't easily identified on their websites, and they did not provide us with that information because we did ask for it specifically on this survey. But we only
had
two.
How many reported they do have bonus plans out of the universe you scoured?
Two organizations offered, but I want to make a note that when we pulled the published survey data out of Perlmeyer Comp Data and ERI, all of those surveys did indicate bonuses.
Okay, so that would overstate our above market to the extent that those are underreported.
Well, yeah, you know what, but we did look at them because of all of the zeros, and I did provide Kelly with this information. I don't have it right up in front of me. I think that most of the medians be in the group of numbers, you know, the median is that figure right in the middle. So even if someone had, even if two organizations did report bonuses, there is the possibility that it was zero for bonuses.
Yep. Well, thank you. Somebody else had a question?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, this is Mark Malvo. On the compensation, total compensation, am I reading it correctly? I guess what my question is, in terms of the executive management compensation, which is showing a median of 22.1 above the median, mm-hmm. and where would that rank in terms of if you're looking at a bell curve? If you can, obviously we don't have that data, but how far off is that? You know, I guess the question is, how rare is it to be at that percentage from the data that, you know, from your experience?
Well, you know what? Not bad. And I'll tell you why. Because if you look at a salary range, and I'm going to show this to you as we go through. Well, this is total compensation, right? But even at the executive. Not unusual because the most difficult thing here is that we are comparing just actual salary against actual salary. And there's a lot of factors that go into actual salary. What is your performance? How are you being measured? You know, particularly at the executive ranks.
I guess the question
I didn't find that disturbing.
if you were looking at a percentile, would that 22% be like in the, you know, the 90th percentile of executive management compensation, the 80th? Is there any data point in that regard?
You know what? I did not calculate that, but I would be happy to and give that to Kelly so she can share that with you.
Okay.
And I guess it just depends on the set of numbers.
Yeah. One question I have, you know, obviously there's a divergence between executive management and staff. I guess the question is, and I probably should know this, is what's the total number of the pool number for executive management as opposed to staff?
It is
four. How many
are
in each group?
Yeah, I'm just double checking. I believe it's four, but I want to make sure. Yep, there are four positions in the executive management.
Yeah, there's four in executive management. It's the executive director, the CIO, the CFO, and the general counsel.
Okay. And how much? What's our staff number?
15.
You had 15 for the others. So a total of 19 because we have some vacancies, is that right? Oh, that you had
math
is
15
for.
Because that's where we had data on both ends, yeah.
But our staff is 24 or 25 currently.
Yeah. There were like three jobs that we didn't get enough data. We didn't have data on both sides from the fund and the market. Mm-hmm. Okay. But I will make a note to get that. You know, what percentile are you falling in? I'll give that to Kelly. Okay. All right. Any other questions on this slide? Okay. So taking a look at, you know, the overall results, one of the things when we do total compensation studies, it's important for an organization to analyze the pay and the benefits separately. And here is why. In order to attract people to come to want to work for you, you need to have competitive pay, a competitive pay plan. Otherwise, people aren't even going to want to come. Once they get there, or you can't attract that desired level of candidate, in order to facilitate retention, you need to have a benefit program that has offerings consistent with what you'll see in the market and is affordable to employees. If the benefit program isn't competitive on those measures, one of the results is that there could be retention problems. So although we analyze these two items separately, you should communicate the package, the full package, to employees so they can understand the total investment that you as an organization are making in each individual. Okay. That makes sense?
Kelly, do you want to comment about the competitiveness of your retirement plan for attracting employees? You said you've had some issues there.
Yeah, I mean, and I think this is one of the issues that's kind of skewing the some of the numbers to the high side. I mean, DPFP pays what DPFP pays for reasons, and those reasons are different, just as in the same as it, you can say that for every organization. I mean, we can survey the market for, let's say, the CFO position, and we can get survey results to say this is the market salary, this is the average in the market. But I know specifically, you know, 2 years ago when we were trying to fill the CFO position, I couldn't find anybody to work here. And to get somebody at that market level, they would have had to come from another governmental entity. And what I was told from several people is that they wouldn't come work with us because, well, the city people couldn't come. City of Dallas people couldn't come because of our bill. But that anybody from another city would not come to work for us because we were not in TMRS specifically, and they didn't want to lose their TMRS service. So that pool of people was out. So we can survey, which we did, you know, the market for the CFO against those people, but they weren't really viable candidates because they won't come work here. So in that particular instance, it took us over a year to find Brenda, and thank goodness we found Brenda. We used a headhunter, and we ended up having to kind of go into a pool of people that are paid more in line with what you make as a CFO in public companies. So that's, you know, that's one reason why that particular position, you know, may not fall exactly in line with the market. You know, and there's a story behind my position, and there's a story behind, you know, people that have been with the system for 20 years or 12 years or those types of things. So it's hard to, when you have a small employee group like this, to really say, I mean, you can't just take the numbers and form a conclusion without kind of looking at the environment. That's what I would add there, I guess, though.
Yeah, Kelly, this is Mark. I completely agree that we're talking about a pretty small, fairly small pool and have unique circumstances. Just one thing we just need to be mindful of is that if we're moving to make some serious changes in terms of rehabilitating the fund and getting it on a stronger path, one of those issues that we'll need to be able to answer is, you know, information like this. And that makes it we need to be able to know how to respond to that.
And, you know, and can you go to the prior slide again? Because I, you know, based on these comments that you all made, I want to make another comment about this. This doesn't tell these numbers don't tell the whole story, right? Kelly gave a perfect example of this is just the litmus test. How do you fall based on the market? But all of the things that go behind that aren't represented here, right? This is just how do you stand against just, they're just numbers. It doesn't mean good, bad, or other because, you know, there may be reasons why, as Kelly mentioned, your executive management is that far over market. And really it's driven by two jobs in that group. So with a small number of jobs, it's not like you've got 100 employees that we're looking at and it's distributed over a large group. So that's another thing to keep in mind. So. Good point, Kelly. Okay, so then if we can go, let me see, two slides ahead. The next slide, we look at the overall recommendations for benefits. Based on, you know, all of the information that I've presented, we did believe that, you know, it might be worth looking at the overall retirement package since it was lagging the market. Given that there's no participation in Social Security, there's no defined benefit program, and the contributions to the mandatory defined contribution plan is lower than the market average. Again, that one's not a popular option, but it does warrant consideration if, you know, neither of the other two options are viable. Okay. Contributions to the health plan premiums are lagging the market, and we would suggest, I mean, they're not terrible, but they are just lower. So we would recommend that you take a look at that, and maybe it's not possible, but that's just one of the other areas that kind of stood out as lagging. The comparator market average is closer to the 90-10 premium share split. Okay, on to the next page with regards to pay. What are our recommendations here? So we are recommending that the fund implement a formal salary structure with each job assigned to an appropriate range within the structure based on the market median salaries. As I showed you at the beginning of the presentation, the majority of organizations do have formal salary ranges, and we talked about the benefits of a salary range. We also recommend that when looking at the data, you use the market median data as the primary metric because we have such a small number of comparator organizations that, and when you use an average number, that average can be pulled higher or lower by extreme salaries. They might be still within the appropriate standard deviation metric, but it can pull them higher or lower. And the median salary is more representative of a specific point in the distribution. It's not pulled higher or lower by salaries at the extreme ends of the distribution. And so it's a more neutral measure of central tendency, and it's good when you're taking a look at smaller groups. Okay. So now let's move on to the next slide and say, what does the salary structure look like? So we developed this salary structure, and it's, I wish I had a pointer so I could point at what I'm looking at, because it's kind of an eye chart here. We created the salary range midpoints based on the market data. Okay. So the salary range midpoints were developed, and we looked at what should the range spread be. And as you can see, that the range spreads across all of the groups are not consistent. So the 40% range spreads, and I kind of explain it here, these are more operational types of jobs up through grade 7. You have a narrower range spread, the distance from the minimum to the maximum, because the learning curve in these jobs is quicker. And therefore, your desired goal is to pay employees at the market rate once they are fully functioning in their role. So that's why you see the learning curve is shorter, the range spread is shorter. When we get to grade 8 and above, these are more of where the majority of your professional level positions are falling, degree, professional level. These have a 50% range spread. Your learning curve is a little longer, and it also, you want it a little wider because you want to promote retention. You want to have sufficient salary growth for these folks, because you're probably going to be hiring them close to around the midpoint if you're hiring an experienced person into the role from the outside. At the management and supervisory levels, starting here at about grade 15, you see the ranges get wider to 60%. Again, larger learning curve. There's limited growth opportunities for managers. The next step for them in your organization is the executive ranks. So you want to promote retention also here, and so you have a wider salary range. Then at these executive ranks down here, the higher level positions, you see a 70% range spread. There is a reason for that. The learning curve here is the greatest in these positions. Tenure tends to be longer. So what this does is it allows for continued salary growth. Does someone have to get to the maximum? No, they don't have to, unless your goal is to get people to the maximum of the salary range, which is not a goal, you know, that I would recommend for an organization. But for these levels, if you're hiring an experienced person who has been an executive director, who has been a CFO, who has been the general counsel, or a CIO, you are most likely going to be hiring them around the market rate to get the desired candidate that you want. Or you may even hire them a little bit above here because this is the market rate for the job. So you want to provide for salary growth opportunity. I'm going to talk about what the salary ranges mean, you know, within the salary range, where people tend to fall within the range, because just because you're up here at the range maximum does not mean that you are overpaid. It's within the acceptable realm of what you should be paid for the role that you have at the organization and your contributions. Okay. The other thing I want to talk about here has to do with this midpoint to midpoint spread. And that is the distance from grade one midpoint to grade two midpoint. You see a lot of 7% in here, but there are certain points where you see jumps, and you see these jumps where you see the range spread widen. The reason for this, keeping in mind, this was built based purely on the market data that we obtained. And what we saw in the market data, and this is common, we see this often, that when you move from like the operational ranks, grades, you know, 1 through 7, and you start getting into the professional ranks, we tend to see salary jumps from that operational level to the professional level. That's why we see a jump of 10% here when we get to grade 8. Same thing here at grade 15. We see a 15% jump. That is what we saw in the market. There is a jump from going from those professional individual contributor roles into the supervisory management ranks. That's why we see a 15% jump here. Same here. We saw some jumps at grade 21. This is where we had placed a job, and there was quite a jump there. And then we also saw it at these grades 24 and 25. These are the most senior level jobs in the organization. So we plotted this. We saw these jumps, and we said, all right, so this is what we looked at. How do these midpoints, which are meant to be representative of the market rate, align with the market data we collected? So we tested the structure against the market data, and that's shown on the following slide. And here's what we found. The gold line represents the proposed midpoint in the salary structure that I just showed you for the, each of the respective grades. The orange line is representative of the market rates that we found in the market. The goal is to have these two lines overlapping. And as you can see, this is ideal. This test is the salary structure that we're recommending appropriate based on the market data that we obtained, and this is the answer is yes. This is our check to validate that the structure aligns with the market. So we say, great. Questions on that?
Yeah, I'm on the board of the National Railroad Trust, where we have a staff of about 25 people, and we made it a little simple. We had our spread range more at 70% for everybody at that stage, rather than having this level of complexity for a small group of people, and we do a survey of rates every 3 to 4 years and adjust the market rate based on inflation on interim periods. So I would think as we start to consider this, we want to not make this overly complex. We don't have an HR person. We want to have something that's easy to administer at the same time as being equitable.
So, you know, to that, to your point, that's a great thing. On the, if you want to go to the previous slide, please. One of the things that I've seen organizations do is that while this minimum, you can have an overall, well, that would probably, never mind, it'll complicate things even more, and we don't want to do that. But I understand, I have had clients who said, you know what, we want the range spread to be consistent across all grades, and that's great. Usually when I see that at the lower levels, one of the biggest concerns that I've heard back is that, and again, this is a philosophical thing, if the organization isn't as concerned with hiring, you know, at the minimum or within the first quartile of the range, a wider range spread for here, for these lower grades will work. That will work fine. A lot of it has to do with what is your policy on where you bring people in. And this would all be new to you because, to the fun, because right now there are no ranges, and so you can create your rules as to where people get hired in. So that's not a problem.
Good, thank you.
If that's the direction you'd like to go. Okay, great. All right, so if we can move forward two slides now, let's talk about the salary ranges. And, you know, we talked about, you know, where people fell on the base pay or where, you know, the groups fell within the base pay. We also, you know, when you have a salary range, it's okay, right? If you're 70% wide or 50% wide or 60% wide, you expect if you're a plus 15%, that's okay because you fall within the parameters established for that, the pay of that range. But when you look at a salary range, we typically have some guidelines of where you would expect to see people within a salary range. This first quartile, which is from the midpoint in 25% of the range, those are typically people who are new to a job, new promotions. This is a you know, a stretch opportunity for them. They're learning in this area. In the second quartile, you know, they've come up to speed, they're performing most of the work, you know, they have the same knowledge base, et cetera. They're still learning, not quite there. Once they get to the midpoint, this is the market rate, and you would expect someone who is fully functioning in their role to at least be at the midpoint. Okay. Beyond the midpoint, if they're in the third quartile, they're performing, you know, they are fully performing, they're experienced in the job, they have the right competencies, they're performing successfully, they're seasoned and proficient in building their job responsibilities. And here in the fourth quartile, they're an expert in their job. They're your go-to person. These are where you find the people who have that institutional knowledge, still stellar performers. They're your expert resource, the role model, the mentor, et cetera, to other jobs in the organization. So if someone falls in here, it doesn't mean you're overpaid. Individually, you know, you could be that star performer, okay? You've been with the organization a long time. Do you want to, and I guess the question becomes, you know, how do you want to reward longevity, that institutional knowledge? You know, and they could be in here. Okay, so let's look at your organization. Now, keep in mind, on the next slide, I plotted jobs into the pay structure based on the market data. I did make one exception because it did, just was not right, based on the internal alignment. I think that this is just based on market data here. I still think part of this, one thing that was not included in the scope of this study was to do a classification study where we looked at all of the jobs. We honed in on them. We had people fill out PDQs, and we evaluated the internal hierarchy of jobs, not people, but jobs in the organization. So we built the structure based on the market data, and we slotted those jobs based on the market data into the appropriate range. And when we did that, I said, all right, well, where do the actual employees fall within the range that we've assigned their job to? And what we found is not terrible. There were two jobs that fell below the minimum of the range. There were seven that were over the max. Okay. The rest of the jobs fell in, there were four that fell into the first quartile. And this is employee pay within those classifications. Four that fell in the second quartile, two people fell in the third quartile of their assigned range, and five fell within the fourth quartile. So when I looked at this and I said, you know, for not having established salary ranges, this is not terrible. Okay. But I wanted to see how do people fall out in the ranges. So not everybody's over max. Not, you know, very few below minimum. The majority fall within the range. Once we did that, then I said, all right, let's take a look at our salary ranges by the assigned grades and how do the fund's average salaries pan out within the salary ranges that we've established. So there's some dots on here. The boxes represent the full salary range. The lower, darker gold is, you know, the minimum to the midpoint, and then the lighter gold is the midpoint to the maximum.
John, will you go to the next slide, please?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm looking at my – thank you.
No, that's okay.
the green dots on here represent the market rate of pay. Again, this is another check for us. Do the market rates of pay for the grades that we established? We want to see those green dots hovering around the midpoint, and they are almost all spot on. When there's green dots at the bottom, that means that we didn't have market data for those particular grades. The orange dots.
Laurie?
Yes.
We're almost 10 o'clock. If you could try to cover these last two or three slides in the next 5 minutes or so, I'd appreciate it.
I can do that. So the red dots are just the average salaries of folks who are where their actual salaries fall. And it just shows you the overmaxes in here and some, and again, their average salaries. So that's just another test on our end. Then from a high-level overview, what are our recommendations? You know, I'm just wrapping it up here. That you adopt formal salary ranges, what that actually ends up looking like, can be discussed, but we think that you should have ranges. Take a look at the retirement program. Take a look at the premium share for the medical programs. And then adopt the proposed salary structure or take a look at it, take it into consideration, allocate jobs into the structure based on the market data results. Or I see I have a footnote there that didn't get put in, or reevaluate the range widths and what have you. And if you do develop salary structures, if you do decide to go on that route, we recommend that you adopt some salary structure guidelines, some salary administration guidelines on how you use the structure. Okay. Finally, with regards to the fiscal impact, two employees were below the proposed range minimum. If the jobs were slotted just as based on market data, the cost to bring those people to the minimum of their salary range would be $13,587. Okay. For those seven employees who have salaries that are greater than the proposed range maximum, we recommend that you red circle those employees and reward them in ways other than adding to their base pay. So, for example, lump sum rewards based on performance. Typically, if people are over the range maximum, there's a higher level of performance expected, and you can reward that way. We also, if you do adopt a salary range, and one of the board members, I think, spoke to this as well, reviewing those, the cost of labor changes on a regular basis and making adjustments to that, the salary ranges, so you keep your salary structure up to date and current with markets. Okay? And that is the end of my presentation. Are there any other questions?
I guess the key thing is that what I think Kelly was hoping to do, and you can add, Kelly, is take all this and come back to the board with a much more focused, concrete recommendation on all of these issues on what we need to do. But would like any of the board's input as she starts to do that.
Right. So just while you're thinking of any specific direction, my thought was I would take this work that Lori's done, which I think is incredibly helpful, and use it as information to try to develop a kind of a pay plan, which will probably take some more in-depth study on the classification pieces that she mentioned, because there are a couple of positions that I'm questioning how the numbers came out. So we want to make sure that those are good matches and we're slotting people appropriately. So I anticipate coming back to you with a salary structure and how the pay plan would work going forward, but also continuing to work with Steve. He wasn't able to be on the call on the medical piece, just to make sure we're doing the best we can there with the medical coverage. He had some insight, which we did provide you this morning, a couple of slides from him, which really confirm what Lori's saying, but looks at it in a slightly different manner. So I think working with him also before we go into the new renewal for our medical for next year is also going to be part of kind of my next steps. And, of course, anything else you'd like to see.
Okay, anybody have any comments or questions or direction?
So Kelly, this is Gilbert. How long do you think that will be? And if I missed it, I apologize. Is that something that will be ready for the next meeting or longer?
Oh, gosh, no. So,
that's what I thought.
My thinking on the medical piece is our renewal, actually, when we did the medical this year, we renewed for a 15-month period. So it's not actually doesn't renew for another, well, basically next April. So what I would want to do is work with Steve to figure out really how we should structure our medical program. We've also used the same broker for a long time, and it might be time to look for other brokers, even though I do think the structure we have is really been good for the system. We might want to look at that. But I don't think there's any need to rush into that before this next budget. And same with the pay plan. I mean, the pay plan I want to get right. Our personnel policies are really old and dated and need to be revamped. So that's a huge effort, which my guess is will take, most of the rest of the year. to put all that together.
So should we just say we'll target end of the year?
Yes. Okay. I would like to target that before we get into the next budget cycle.
Yeah, I just want to put something as a placeholder so we can be responsive.
Yeah, that would put it in October, November if we're doing it before the next budget.
Right, I think that's a good idea.
Perfect.
Okay, anybody else? Going once, twice, three times? Okay, let's move on. We're falling a little behind. We got a little difference between the order.
Sorry, Bill. I just want to thank Lori and tell her that she could drop off. Thanks, Lori.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Lori. Appreciate it. Nick, do you want to give the professional services provider thing? That's next on my order of business, although on our book I think it's one more back. But why don't you go ahead and do that?
Yes. First of all, can you all hear me?
Yes.
Okay. And I think the highlights are that they had very positive things to say about the team and the staff. The one thing they had noted was that over the course of their time being involved, there had been several additions to the team. And so both kind of the people who was chosen and what they were sort of asked and charged with doing, they thought those were very, very good moves on our part. I think the only thing that stood out to me, and they acknowledge this as such, is that, you know, their real skills are on giving advice in the public markets and then on overall asset allocation. So I almost think of like a Google Maps where, you know, you can see the individual homes and the streets and all those sorts of things. Whereas when it comes to the private company and private investment portfolio, they acknowledge that, you know, their level of sort of value add is more limited. And, you know, that just kind of is what it is. So there, you know, in the Google Maps, you might be able to see the neighborhood or the city or something, but not they're not really able to add the granularity. Now, there's nothing that we've done with that portfolio that they disagree with, and they're, you know, very positive on our plan to monetize as quickly as possible. But overall, it's a good call, and you know, we're glad to have them, and they were very positive talking about us compared to other groups they work with. They did say they thought that our skill level across the board was superior to what they had been involved with, particularly with comparable pensions that have the same funding ratio issues that we have. That's all I have.
Okay, any questions for Nick? Okay, if not, then next item is the audit committee recommendation. Brenda had a summary memo in the board book that went through it in detail. But Brenda, let me ask you to just sort of give the highlights, and then I'll add what the audit committee met this week earlier to review this recommendation and support this recommendation. And I'll cover that at that time. So Brenda, it's yours.
Thank you, Bill. I appreciate that. As Bill said, I'm going to be reviewing just the highlights of the recommendation memo that's included in your board materials today, the RFP process, the firm search, evaluation, and the proposal. Our RFP process, we defined the process. And Dawn, if you go up one page, they can see some of the memo if they haven't read it. We defined the search process, the evaluation criteria. We developed the RFP document. We developed a short list to firms to send out the RFP to. Once we received the RFPs back, the staff evaluated those and then discussed them with Bill. We prepared this recommendation memo, and then we met with the audit committee. So after we prepared the RFP documents, one of the first things that I worked on was selecting the firms that we would invite to propose. And I started with Accounting Today's 2019 Top 100 Accounting Firms, narrowed that list down to 25. Then I added accounting firms that other Texas pension systems use. Did additional research to find out which firms had significant employee benefit practices and the number of audits that they performed annually. And then finally, we looked at the list for any conflicts, firms that were doing business with the city or one of our investments. Ultimately, we invited six firms to submit a proposal. Dawn, if you want to go forward one page. The firms were BDO, BKD, Clifton, Larson Allen, or known as CLA, Crow, Grant Thornton, and RSM. Of the four invitees, of the six invitees, four submitted a proposal. BKD declined to propose, and they did not provide any reason for why they were declining. Grant Thornton had planned to propose, but ultimately discovered that they had a conflict, which prevented them from submitting a proposal. The evaluation criteria that we looked at, we designed the RFP to assess whether the firms understood our business, whether they had appropriate resources to work. Of particular interest was their understanding of and their audit approach as it related to assets and the actuarial evaluation. And then we evaluated each of the RFPs based on their responses, questions. There was about 22 areas that we either asked to describe or had questions for. Looking kind of in general areas of what was the overall firm qualifications and the strength of the audit team, their audit approach, and the reasonableness of the hours, the completeness, timeliness of the RFP submission, and finally we looked at their fees, not as a primary factor, but as something to consider. So of the four firms that did send an RFP, BDO, they are our incumbent audit firm. They are the seventh largest accounting firm in the U.S., and along with their audit approach information, the proposal did detail their substantial employee diversity program. They have the benefit of knowing the pension system investment, pension plans, the IT system, and they met the challenge of 2020 by completing our 2019 audit remotely. As it relates to staffing, BDO has maintained the same local partner, manager, and senior on our job during the engagement, and that continuity of staff is very important. The next firm is CLA, and John, if you'll go to the next page, thank you. They're the eighth largest accounting firm in the U.S. Their proposal provided an overview, but little detail regarding their employee diversity program. We had a couple of concerns with their proposal. One is the number of quoted hours that they expected for the audit. It was the lowest among all the firms, and we were wanting to understand the possible implications of that quote, whether it related to the planned depth of the audit or how comprehensive the audit would be, or would we end up with an over-hour audit that would result in them coming back and asking for additional fees. Additionally, we had some concerns about the experience of the manager and that all of the staff for our engagement would be based out of Denver and Denver, Colorado, and Baltimore, Maryland, and we wouldn't have local staff. The next firm that we looked at was Crowe. They're the ninth largest accounting firm. Crowe sponsors what they call business resource groups in their firm, and these BRGs, that they call them, focus on diversity and inclusion for their employees throughout their tenure at the firm. And looking at Crowe's proposal, we were concerned about their use of actuaries, that they only plan to use an actuary for year one to review our actuary report, and we think that's a pretty important step. Also, the actuary that they were planning to use could ultimately result in a conflict for DPSP as we near 2024 and the PRB's review. Along with concerns about the experience of the manager and their responsiveness during the RFP process and their higher fees, they had the highest first-year average hourly rate of any of the firms. The last firm was RSM. John, if you'll move ahead one page. RSM is the fifth largest accounting firm in the U.S. They have culture, diversity, and inclusion programs that cover not just the employees, but also suppliers and community efforts. The audit firm would be based in the staff for our audit would be based in San Antonio and Dallas, but also Illinois. RSM did have quoted hours that were significantly higher than the other firms. And, of course, that also meant that their fees were the highest in this group. CPFP continues to face large challenges. And you can go to the next page, John. With some of our legacy investments, we believe that BDO has knowledge of the issues and the valuation methods for Lone Star and HUS. And we believe that bringing in new auditors at this critical time could unnecessarily complicate the completion of our audit. The staff is recommending that we offer BDO a contract extension. However, instead of the original planned 5 years, that we go for 3 years. And hopefully this 3 years would take us past the liquidation of most legacy assets. One last thing I wanted to mention about BDO is that they did offer two price quotes, one that included the use of offshore services and one that did not. The offshore services group would not perform any member audit work or have access to member information. But choosing that service quote could reduce our fees by an additional $1,000 over the three-year contract. And you would see more information about how BDO's services work on pages, the next couple of pages in, called BDO Rise. If you'll go up a couple of pages, John, one more there, and on the next page talks about BDO Rise, how the onshore and offshore services work. Is there any questions about the RFP process?
Okay. I mean, the audit committee met, which was Tina, Armando, and myself, earlier this week to go through this in detail. I think we concurred with management's recommendation. Again, BDO, the partner, is outstanding. I think there's a real benefit to a local firm. I'd echo what Brenda said, that the complexity of our valuation issues will create some real issues, and we thought through a three-year extension we could get through to when we have to relook at everything for the PRB under the legislation as to where we stand, et cetera. So we thought that was a reasonable thing. And the reasons we eliminated the other folks were reasonable and sensible. And we did feel, and I think the one thing Brenda didn't cover, is that on one of the other pages there's an indication of what work would be done outside in India, basically, to save $20,000. So our thought was that, you know, it wasn't any member-sensitive data. It was what I would call from my audit days, ticking and checking and doing documentation work, that it's worth doing that. So we would recommend that we save money. We can save whatever money we can save, we should. So BDO was a very reasonable alternative. Only one bid was cheaper, and that one we thought probably way underestimated the complexity. So I would recommend, and I would motion that we go ahead and approve the recommendation to hire BDO for a 3-year period. So with that, anybody have any comments or questions they want to raise?
Yeah. Hey, Bill, this is Gilbert. I have a quick comment, and then I'll second the motion. I know BDO, and I've worked with them on other boards and things. But my comment is, you know, these are big contracts, and they're multi-year contracts. And in today's climate and with all the new focus on ESG, I'd like us to start trying to get a little deeper on what they're doing in governance and diversity issues, whether it's the board of their firm or senior partners and things of that nature on gender and race and things of that nature, because that seems to be the direction of where things are going, their board makeup. So I think we should get ahead of that curve.
I think you did ask for that, didn't you, Brenda, in the question? You mentioned that in terms of their diversity.
Yeah.
Well, I'm happy to help Brenda put a matrix together. So it's much more than just a cursory. They're helping with philanthropy and, you know, and things like that. I mean, you know, in these days, there's very detailed matrices on companies and boards and things of that nature. And I'm happy to share that as part of the ESG effort that's going on nationally.
Okay. Well, that's helpful. Did you want to add anything, Brenda?
I was going to say in BDO's proposal, they did provide, I thought, very substantial information about partners, their last partner class. I'd be happy to forward you that particular page on them. Each of the firms provided different levels of information. Some went as far as to do a matrix that showed by gender and by race their employee makeup. Some did more of an overview, but that certainly was a question that each of them did respond to, and I could provide that information if you'd like.
Thank you, Brent. I welcome that.
Okay,
well, that's good. Why don't you send that to Gilbert, and he'll help you with that. In the meantime, anybody else have any comments on the motion to approve the BDO contract for 3 years? Hearing none, I motioned and Gilbert kindly seconded. Anybody opposed? Okay, very good. We've got that carried and unanimously, and we'll move on to the legislative update from Josh.
Thank you.
Sure. There's a number of bills, I guess, for us to talk about. And you all got the bill that was just filed, I guess, late Tuesday, maybe it's Tuesday or Wednesday, by Representative Davis with respect to our system. But I'll go over the other bills first. A number of you have inquired about the federal legislation. I think we've got inquiries from members as well about the COVID bailout bill. I think it's $86 billion. That only relates to funding of the PBGC and plans that are covered by the PBGC. That does not relate to any relief for state and local plans, so that does not apply to our system or to really any public system. Just wanted to make sure that was clear with everybody. In terms of pension bills themselves, there haven't been that many. There's been, as always, there's bills relating to the employee's retirement system, teacher's retirement system, proposing defined contribution plans for both and dealing with funding and prohibiting certain asset investments and things like that. None of those relate to us. There's also, as there was last session, a bill, a proposed constitutional amendment that prohibits the use of state funds to pay obligations of local pension systems. I think that's understood, and that didn't go anywhere last year. I don't know if it will go anywhere this year or not, especially given the challenging legislative environment we have, not only with COVID, but then with the blackout issues, the power issues. I think everything has really become much more difficult from a legislative perspective. There was one bill that had a potential impact on pensions dealing with domestic relations orders and spousal maintenance. Some people were concerned about it. Texpers got involved, and there's an amendment that will be proposed that will make clear that it does not in any way abrogate the pension system's rights to approve domestic relations orders, which is currently what's in the Section 804 of the Government Code. So I think that should not be an issue as well. There was some talk about a bill that would give the PRB more powers. And in fact, there was a pension committee's hearing, I believe yesterday, and the executive director was at points in time anew indicated that they don't have powers to do certain things, and some of the representatives were sympathetic to that. But to my knowledge, that bill has not been filed. And then with respect to the bill that we've proposed, we are hoping that we will get that filed either today or tomorrow in the House. We've run up against timing issues because our start was delayed and because it's just very difficult now given all the legislative roadblocks because of the because of COVID and the power issue. But we are optimistic that the bill will get filed and hopefully get a hearing in the Pensions Committee. So that's all the other bills. And then there is the bill that was filed by Representative Davis dealing with lump sum distributions, both with respect to drop as well as lump sum distributions of a surviving spouse who's receiving a survivor benefit. And basically, it's broken up into a number of sections. One, it's the survivor. It gives the right for someone who's getting a survivor benefit to get a partial lump sum distribution in the case of an emergency or financial hardship. It also gives the right for someone who's retiring to get their whole drop account paid out in full. And then it gives the right for someone who is basically getting a drop account from a member to apply for a financial hardship, to apply for a distribution in the case of an emergency or financial hardship. Right now, the statute only allows members to apply for that financial hardship. So that's what Representative Davis proposed. I'll kind of give it over to Kelly to kind of give her views of the financial aspects of the bill.
Okay, so I looked at the numbers in our financial statements when I read the bill, and basically between the actives, which is about $154,000, and then the $890,000 of the present value of the drop annuities, if there was the ability to take lump sum, all the money out in a lump sum and drop, we would lose more than half of our balance, which obviously is a solvency issue for the pension system. So that, of course, would be of concern. I did talk to the PRB this morning to make sure I understood the process of how things would work. And if this bill does get a committee hearing, we will be asked or required to, it's not a choice, submit an actuarial analysis of the impacts. We would submit that to the PRB, and then they would give a second opinion, and that would go with any information before a committee hearing, if it gets granted a committee hearing.
So I guess the question for the board is whether the board wants to take a specific position
on the bill. I think if the board is inclined to oppose the bill, then the board can make a motion to that effect, and we've got one prepared to show the board if the board's so inclined on that. I think that it would, if that's the direction, then it is usually helpful for the legislature to understand that the what the position of the pension system and the board is on this. I would expect that the city of Dallas would come out strongly against the bill as well. I don't know that for a fact, but I don't know that anyone's had any specific conversations with the city, but I would be surprised if the city didn't take that position. So that's what I've got on all the legislative update at this point.
Hey, Josh and Kelly, it's Armando. Just real quick, I want to summarize what I heard. A bill has been filed to allow lump sum distributions and emergency hardship distributions. And if the bill was to succeed through this legislative session, it could have a crippling effect on our fund. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes.
Okay. Do we know what the city's position is? Has anybody had any type of, I'm assuming, just like Josh, I'm assuming that they're going to come out in against this bill, and they're going to work to kill it. But do we know any, do we have any particulars on that?
I did send it to Elizabeth last night. She had actually already seen it. She's working on another issue. Her email says at the Capitol today. And it says her legislative folks have told her they are handling it. So I don't know what that means, but that's the email that I received from Elizabeth.
In addition to that, Armando, I have sent the mayor a note to make him aware. I just became aware of this at about 9:30 last night and sent it to Kelly and Josh, and they had not been made aware of it at that time. So this morning I sent the mayor a note and his policy director a note, making them aware of this and trying to, make sure that they were focused on this issue.
So I just wanted to also just point out, you know, we recognize the fact that it was not the intention that surviving spouses wouldn't be able to ask for hardships, but it was poor drafting when the bill was passed, and there's nothing we can do about that without legislative change. But this just goes well beyond that, and it's too difficult, I think, to try to separate that issue out. Too damaging, and potentially bad things could happen on the floor. Had they just maybe offered just that change, I think it might have been a different story. The board would have maybe looked at it different, but this right now would put us back to only a few years until insolvency. As it's written.
This is right. It puts us right back at 2016. That's what it does.
Yep. This is Alan. When was this bill filed? Do we know?
It looks like it was filed sometime Tuesday. I'm not quite sure. Could have been end of the day. I'm not quite sure. We found out about it yesterday.
Do we know who filed it?
Representative Davis.
Okay. And the reason I ask is usually you see a flurry of last-minute bill filings. Tomorrow's the deadline to file new bills, other than rare exceptions. And I just know, personally speaking, as a legislator, stuff that I didn't have, full compassion in, but, agreed to file, a lot of that got filed the last week, because things start really moving up and getting through all of the committees and getting hearings. I think time is on our side. I mean, I'm glad y'all caught this, and I'm glad our team in Austin's aware of it, because it's a lot easier to stop a bill than it is to get one passed. But I think I just wanted to throw a little background that, tomorrow's the deadline, so maybe that's why we're seeing this pop up at the last minute. But in any event, it's something we you know, it would destroy everything this team has been able to accomplish in moving forward. It would destroy everything the legislature intended to do with the help that was given, modifications that were given a couple of years ago. So, yeah, this is not good. We need to, you know, make sure our team in Austin staying on top of it and coordinate with the city and probably others.
Yeah, I totally agree with you, Alan.
This is Tina. Oh, can I just want to kind of ask a question as well. So one of the issues that came up is, like, I just want to dissect this in some way. So, Kelly, are you alluding to the fact that it was poorly written and that maybe the hardship application would extend to the spouses despite the fact that they're non-members if they are widowers or widowy? You know what I'm saying? Like, that's one of the issues, because that can go hand in hand, right? If you have, if it's extended to the spouse of a member who's no longer living, it could be easily hand in hand as far as hardship she's suffering because of this death. So that's kind of like
right. That
in itself.
So what I meant, you know, what I was saying is when the bill was drafted, the 2017 bill was drafted, it used the term member. And a member is, you know, the original employee. It is not the spouse. And so
there is
no wiggle room in that language for us to allow a hardship distribution to somebody that was not an employee, you know, a former employee. So we're stuck, basically, until we get that changed. And there are several things in the bill we would like changed, from the disability language, that language, some of the other things. But it's not the right time. And we definitely do not want to kind of start picking and choosing and have a bill that we don't, that has a bunch of other things in it like this. So that's what it is.
I'll also point out that the bill is adding a phrase emergency in addition to financial, making it separate from financial hardship for all these cases, which some of the board was involved when the board first determined what was the financial hardship back in 2017, and those were a lot of difficult conversations. And, you know, emergency is intended to be a whole different aspect, which may or may not broaden, well, probably does broaden sort of the category of what would be susceptible to a distribution. So that is also just it's a sub-issue to the whole lump sum distribution, but nevertheless, it's an important issue as well, I want to point out.
Josh, again, but it seems to me that it's similar in hardships, because I was part of that difficult conversation, and the fact that it's, you know, unforeseeable, and that definition of unforeseeable we kind of whittled down too. I mean, we have some very stringent hardship things, is what I'm saying. So for it to be like an emergency versus hardship is going to be very narrowly defined.
Well, if the legislation were to pass, it would be up to you as the board to try to, you know, define it in terms of the drop policy for sure.
Now, Josh, you said you had a motion that you had prepared for us. Can that be put on the screen for people to look at?
Yeah, John, can you put that up?
Okay. Now, is there anybody that feels they need to get any more legal background when we go into closed session, or should we go ahead and entertain this motion now?
I'd like to entertain the motion now.
Okay. So you're making that motion, Armando?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I would second it. So let's see if we can pass this. Anybody opposed to this motion that's out there, authorizing staff to work with DPFP legislative consultants to oppose the legislation? Anybody oppose? Not hearing anybody. We have passed that motion then.
So this is Alan, and one thing we might want to think about doing is coordinating with our folks in Austin to maybe get a visit with Representative Davis and maybe get me involved. Because, I mean, so, sometimes bills get filed that have unintended consequences, and I don't know what the intent was behind that, but it might do some good to visit with the bill author, maybe somebody with the Buddy's team and me, with Representative Davis about, you know, our concerns. So, you know, the objection is understood. Just throwing that out there for thought.
I would encourage that. Can we make that happen, Kelly? Can we get Alan and the Hilco guys together to do that?
Absolutely.
Let's do that. That makes a lot of sense, Alan. Thank you for volunteering.
Okay. Sure.
Can I? We've talked in the past about hiring a PR person. This sounds like a perfect example, because if we are in a partnership with the City of Dallas and there are things like hardship, emergency, widows, I mean, like, that looks, that just has this kind of skew that looks, you know, and because there are some things that we might want to change, but because it's all lumped in, we have to oppose it. I really think that this is definitely in light of, you know, maybe potential future things we're asking of the city and its, you know, taxpayers. I just feel like this is a, you know, a little smoke on the horizon.
Yeah, this is Ken. I agree with Tina on that. I would love to see the PR firm get involved in this, because, you know, this could be skewed as a way that oh, the pension doesn't like widows, they don't want to help them, and I don't want that to happen. So I would definitely endorse getting our PR firm involved.
Okay, let's do that, Kelly. We just came up, but we had them in last month. Let's get them engaged on this.
Okay, we'll talk to them and to Hilco to see how, I mean, we want to make sure we're handling things appropriately. I mean, this may never even get a hearing, so it might cause more smoke by trying to do something than not. But we'll work with the two combined to see what the right path is.
Well, I just think that we are prepared to have a response like we've never had before. Not that we would initiate a response, but we would basically be reacting, but be prepared.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you, Tina.
Okay, anything else on this? If not, let's go, Kelly, to your... So you've got a couple of reports there before we get to Kent.
I do, and I will try to go quickly because I know we are behind. So you have your normal contribution report on page 78. This is the March report with the January data. Since we did cross into a new year, we have a new floor amount. The new floor increases the city contributions for this year by $4.1 million. You can see that on page 79, that is reflected in the kind of the lower percentages you're seeing in that second to last column there. But the city still is on track. Nothing has changed there. Their hiring plan did estimate another 25 police officers, so it looks like they have fewer officers than they did the prior month, but that's just because their goal went up. So with that, unless there's any questions, I can move on to the next item.
Okay.
Okay. The trustee training, education, and travel item, Ken Haben has asked to attend the TechSPERS 2021 legislative workshop. That's a one-day workshop in Austin. It's nominal cost, and it is within his budget. If you approve his attendance to that, we will sign him up.
Okay, I'll move approval. Does somebody want to second it?
Armando,
thank you, Armando. Anybody opposed to it?
Bill, would you like me to cover the executive director's report since I'm on a roll?
Sure, might as well. Please do.
Okay, so the executive director's report, the monitors, the NCPERS monitors reports are there for your information. We have had four open records requests since the last board meeting. One has been filled. The other three are in process. I'm not sure we have information for one of them, but we're working through those. As far as education goes, we had hoped to have something posted on the website before today's meeting. but I got a phone call this week that has made me rethink that a little bit. But what we are doing is we've got 11 different sessions that we will be scheduling on Zoom to do education sessions for employees, and we are not doing classes like we used to do where there are full 8 hours of the day, because that's really hard to sit through a Zoom that way. So we're splitting those into kind of 2-hour blocks where somebody can tune in to say, here are my pension basics, here's how drop works, here's how the beneficiaries work, those types of things. So we have come up with a schedule for that. The reason I'm kind of rethinking this is I did get a call from one of the police stations, and they asked us to come out and do a presentation for them. And what we'd like to do is kind of tailor the presentation a little bit to do on Zoom and have them at 7:30 in the morning that works for them. So we're tweaking it a little bit based on that phone call, but you'll see that on our website, and people will be able to attend via Zoom and a lot more educational opportunities. So that should be out there by the beginning of next week at the latest. And that is all I had on that item.
Any questions for Kelly? If not, Kent, and Kent, Leo, Aaron, you guys are up for the next block of time, so let's move forward.
All right, this is Kent. Hello, everyone. We'll move to slide 88, please, and that's the asset allocation. And just a couple things to cover here. We did complete the move of $157 million within global equity to the new Northern Trust passive global equity account. We used Russell to help us on the transition there, and so that went well. Cash is, shows here at $73 million, but it's actually, as of last night or the night before, sitting at about $114 million because we had some recent real estate distributions, and we will consider the potential redeployment or the redeployment of those assets. It's likely that we'll be looking at global equity. There are some small variances within fixed income, but overall the safety reserve is solidly funded, and the other amounts are kind of almost operationally too small to warrant a contribution right now. But we'll review all that with Makita before we move any money around. Moving on to the next slide, please. So just trying to put a little more data on, what we're doing on the top folks in terms of liquidation of private markets. So just mention here that we have received $21.5 million to date. At the time of press, we had expected $26 million, kind of in the rest of the second or through the end of the second quarter. We got 23 of that in the last couple of weeks, and so we've got actually 3 plus another 4 that are likely and identified. That doesn't mean something else won't pop up or something, you know, we'll lose it along the way, but that's the cash that we're predicting right now. Let's see, ongoing activity across the end of life private equity and other private market funds. We've been interacting and with both kind of GPs and LPs and others, interested parties, and Lone Star, Huff, TRG, Asian Infrastructure Funds. So we're continuing to spend time and try to understand and do what we can to move those towards monetization. And I talked about, we mentioned kind of $24 million potential contribution. Could be... already talked about that. We're now kind of moving into working on the small cap search, and we'll talk a lot about most of the rest of this. I think probably it's best to just move over to the investment advisory committee because we're going to talk about a lot of that in there. But before we do, any questions about the portfolio? Okay. For the Investment Advisory Committee, I'll mention that the draft minutes are later in your packet in the other confidential information. It starts on 268, page 268, if you want to look at those. But the Investment Advisory Committee requested and they were able to move the meeting from later in March to March 2nd so that they could review the proposed revisions to the investment policy prior to this meeting. And also provide some initial input regarding asset allocation. So we met with them on March 2nd. Everyone was there. And just some highlights. And I guess I'll turn it over to Gilbert to see if he wants to make any comments. And I'll fill in anything else.
No, go ahead and keep driving. You know, I'll fill in the gaps on one or two of the actions we took. But go ahead and please keep driving.
Okay. Thank you, Gilbert. The previous recommendation from the Investment Advisory Committee that we take a look at our public markets benchmarks, both from an administrative point of view to make sure that they were consistent across our contracts and performance measurements, as well as looking at some specific issues related to style. And so staff did a comprehensive search on that and also kind of checked in with Makita evaluation. And so there were a couple of administrative things that required administrative updates to the investment management agreements. But the bigger issues were that we looked at our public equity managers to see if benchmark them to style-specific benchmarks would be appropriate. And in all cases, where we could see there were definitely style biases, the value growth, but there were kind of no indications where it was obvious that they should be on a style benchmark as opposed to a core benchmark. And then the other thing was the short-term bond asset class and our manager in their income research, there is both exposure to credit securities as well as securitized securities, and the benchmark for that is the asset class and the manager is the 1 to 3 year treasury. And so this issue was brought up by the Investment Advisory Committee, and you know we've known that, but we have been looking at performance versus other benchmarks, but we wanted to see if we could kind of formalize that. And so we worked with Income Research, and they had recommended the Bloomberg Barclays 1 to 3 year aggregate benchmark, and we did a lot of analysis around that, and it does appear to be a good fit, and we showed that to the Investment Advisory Committee, and they're concurred and are recommending that we adopt that benchmark. And you will see that in the following item on the investment policy where we've updated the benchmark for the short-term bonds, this 1 to 3 year Bloomberg Barclays. The Investment Advisory Committee also recommended initiating a watch list, procedures for managers, and recommended kind of evaluating them against specifically looking at managers that had underperformed their benchmarks by the 1, 3, and 5 year. So it's kind of outperforming any of those groups would be a mitigating factor. And that even then, there's not an automatic watch. It's just that would trigger us to take a look at them. And staff's always looking at everybody all the time, but it is something that kind of flags a manager to make sure we're looking at them. Moving on, they did review the investment policy revisions, and they did recommend maintaining the goal referencing the actuarial return as well as removing the goal relating to peer ranking. We also spent time talking about the asset allocation, and they had a lot of input, but primarily was focused on really taking a look at our bond allocation and a bias towards growth versus the bond allocations or lowering bond allocations. So we're just getting started, but we'll take that under advisement. And finally, as part of the small cap search process, the investment policy directs that the Investment Advisory Committee should be advised on those processes. And so we proposed a process that was similar to what we used for our bond search last year, modified as appropriate for this search. And the Investment Advisory Committee was supportive of that approach, making note that want to make sure that we cast a wide net so that we are appropriately considering diverse managers. So Gilbert, correct me or fill in.
Yeah, please. No, I think that's good.
Okay.
Most of this, I think, is just in the zone of maintenance. Putting managers on watch doesn't mean they're fired. It doesn't mean you're going to be fired. It just means what's happening. It just raises to the issue of we need to look at, is there something going on in the market? Is there something going on with personnel? It's just good discipline. So, no, I think everything's more on the administrative side. So that's all I have, Kent.
Thank you, Gilbert. Quick check for questions on anything? Okay, moving on to the investment policy. And recall, we brought the proposed revisions to the last board meeting, and there's just two changes since then. So if we can turn to page 95, John. And previously, in the previous version, we had deleted the goal number two kind of at the bottom of the page, 2A, number two there, where it says earn a long-term net of fees investment return greater than the actuarial return assumption. And my initial thought there was that this was kind of a circular logic because, you know, to some extent, the actuarial return is driven, the assumption is driven by the investment policy asset allocation. But it is true that we do want to beat that or and meet that. So I think that's good feedback, and we've reinstated that in the policy. And then we had the next goal down, ranking the top half of the public fund universe. We had suggested either eliminating that or, you know, moving it down to an objective. And if you look at the page 96, we've deleted that kind of as the objective, and that was incurred in accordance with the Investment Advisory Committee recommendation. And so entertain any questions on the investment policy, and then we'll hopefully have a motion and approval of the investment policy revisions.
Okay. Gilbert, I assume you would motion approval of these changes?
That's correct. I'll make that motion.
Ken, you're on the committee. Would you second those?
Yes.
Okay. We have a motion and a second. Any discussion or any questions before we vote? Not hearing any. Anybody opposed to adopting the investment policy statement as amended? No. Okay. It is approved. Thank you, everybody. And now we're going to go on to the asset allocation review, Leandro. I think try to hit the high points on this because, I mean, I think everybody knows how asset allocation works, but you'll be going through this in a lot more detail once you come back with your results and your study and your new recommendation. So let's try to hit the high points at this point.
Thank you, Bill. We'll do that, and we can certainly do the same thing with the reports later in our presentation. So to me, it's important to have this quick recap because there's some staff and trustees that are new that were not here when this was done the last time, so I think you provide some good context. For further perspective, Makeda has been working with you now for about 3 years, and the first order of business for us was to review the whole asset allocation. At the time, if you were to look at the February 2018 materials, there were three options being contemplated with respect to asset allocation. So option number one was with the liquid assets, which at the time were about half of the fund, go fairly aggressive because that was potentially needed to make the returns that are needed actuarially, understanding that there is a risk if markets go south, it could be severely impacted. Option number two at the time was to be agnostic and essentially treat the liquid assets separately from the liquid assets. And option number three was to be more conservative with those assets because there was risk with the liquidity. Risk not necessarily under the lenses of volatility, but under the concept of uncertainty, meaning what is the true value and when are we going to be able to monetize these assets. So after a lot of review and discussions and analysis, the ultimate advice we gave you that staff supported and ultimately the trustees voted was to be more conservative on the liquid piece of the assets until there is more visibility with respect to the liquid assets, especially the legacy assets. And at the time, there were also some questions, at least from Irene, on what the contributions level was going to be. For example, there was the CD hiring plan versus what was actual then. So that is the premise. The first part of this presentation provides essentially a recap of what happened over the last couple of years. And then, you know, we can move more quickly over the rest. So I don't plan to take 20 minutes, but I will just take a few to, again, hit the highlights. So if we were to compare today versus 3 years ago, there's been some improvement and some more material and some less. On the one hand, contributions have come at a pretty good pace. So that has led to an improvement, for example, in the net cash outflow, which used to be something more like $10 million a month, and that has been coming down to nine or less than nine today. Funding status has gotten a bit weaker, from 50 to about 45%. Illiquid assets have come down a little bit, from about 25%, 26% to about 22%, looking at the fair value of assets as reported. I know staff sometimes conduct the adjustment, and that is probably more realistic, but, you know, so we got to look and monitor both. The assumed rate of return went down from 7.25% to 7%, and that's what we have today. Nikita conducts estimates for a variety of asset classes, return, risk, volatility, and correlation, at least on a yearly basis, in years when there is a lot of changes in the market, as was the case last year or in 2008, we do it more than once. In your policy, you have stated that you have the goal to conduct an asset allocation study every 3 years or as directed by the board, so we're right on time to do it now after 3 years. And in your investment beliefs, you state that this is the most important decision because it has the greatest impact on return. So the expectations over the next few meetings will be coming back to you with work, with analysis, so that ultimately in the next few months, we can potentially have an updated policy. There's been things that change in the market. The level of interest rates is lower than it was 3 years ago. Valuation for most asset classes is richer, and that means the forward-looking return expectations on a variety of asset classes is lower now than it was about 3 years ago. There was also a decision in November of 2020 to essentially defund the allocation to global bonds, and so there was a decision to wait until this asset allocation study is being conducted or will be conducted to redeploy that. So once you do that, again, you will go and change the investment policy statement. So let me just speak just a couple of key pages, and I thought I had a question. If not, let me just go through a couple of key pages. Let me see. To start, okay, here we go. So the first one, maybe you can start on page 114 or page 7 of 34, which is the legacy assets, because this was a big driver of the decisions that were made 3 years ago. So at the time, in the spring of 2018, legacy assets were about $543 million. Now they are about $100 million less, as reported, and still with some uncertainty as to, again, the timing and the actual value of the monetization of these assets. And so we are now entering the fourth year, and this will be, again, a very important input into the analysis that will be presented to you. Next, if we skip two pages, we'll show you some slides that were done in 2018 that we'll revisit now, and we'll share in the next few meetings updates and progress. One was the funded status, and I'm on page 116. One was the projected funded status based upon the contribution level team to this plan. Another time, you could see that there was very different outcomes as to what the contribution levels were going to be, and so far, happy to see that the contributions have been on the higher end, very close to, very closely aligned with the city hiring plan, which is great. So that is the top line. On the next one, this is also an important piece of the decision to have the safety reserve, essentially to immunize or to be very confident that no matter what happens in the market or to contributions or benefits, we are very covered for the next 2.5 years. So on this page 117, we essentially assume that over the next 20 years, the plan was going to meet its return assumption target, except in 1 year in which the fund essentially would perform similar to 2008 given its asset class breakdown. And so the key message here was that because it have net cash outflows, which at the time were about 6% or 120 million per year, the timing of a shock matters. And so if you had a severe market correction and a severe impact to the assets in the fund, that could jeopardize the path to solvency and the path to 100% funded to some degree. And so it was very important to essentially try to truncate that left distribution of returns. And you can see that if you have a major correction 15 years out, the impact is much less severe. What you see at the right is the funded status at year 20. And so we're pleased to see that during the past 3 years, there was no major such hit to the fund. And the last one that I'll hit is this one, which looked at several scenario analyses, essentially going from the base case study, looking at more of a more muted bond-like performance for the fund during the first 5 years, and then it meets the actuarial return.
John, can you hit the next slide, please?
Quarter. Sorry, this is page 118. And then option C, D, and F are more challenging. So, for example, the performance of the liquid assets begins to negate gains and other pieces of the portfolio. So what we've seen in the last 3 years was much closer to B than any of the others with, you know, probably an average return somewhere between 3 and 4%. Let me skip to page 125. I think we may have gone over this slide at some point in time in the past, but this essentially shows that it is more challenging now. There's more headwinds. It's not impossible. It's just not as easy as it used to be, you know, in the 80s when level of interest rates were very high. So this is a fairly simplistic model, but essentially it highlights that, you know, it is more challenging now than ever before, given where we start with very low level of interest rates and very high valuations across most asset classes. This looks, of course, at a very simplistic stock and bond portfolio, and the line it represents the probability of meeting a 7% rate of return. And so it's been decreasing, and it is no surprise that when you expect a stock and bond portfolio to have more challenges meeting these returns, alternative assets will come to the rescue, and that's why you've seen over the last 20 years increasing demand for all kinds of alternative assets. Now, the problem with alternative assets is that unlike stock and bond portfolios where you have a very narrow set of distributions, with alternatives, you can do very well or you can do very poorly, so that the average is not quite as meaningful in modeling versus the other asset classes. To wrap up and speed up, 128 here shows how expected returns across asset classes over the last decade has come down between 1% or 2%. And slide 129 shows traditional mixes with the stock and bond portfolios using Mikita's inputs as of January 1, 2021. You know, a 90-10 portfolio pretty much gives you that 7%. That takes a lot of risk. Most investors won't go there. So there's other things, including uses of alternatives and other categories that have become more prevalent in portfolios, to the point that I wouldn't even call private equity and real estate alternative investments. They become pretty much mainstream today. I will skip all the way to page 137. On page 137, we have your current policy, which was established in late 2018, together with the ranges and an implementation plan to get there.
John, I think here we are. One more page, 147, John. Leo, we're off. We had additions to our policy since we sent it out to you. So John has been valiantly kind of adjusting himself. No, it's not your fault. So we're on page 31 of 34.
Yes, correct. I'm on the slide that says current asset allocation policy established in late 2018.
Okay, 146, John.
There you go. Apologies for that. I was trying to move faster and went to my own non-Zoom screen. So this is the policy, so this should be pretty familiar. On the next page, we compare the expected return assumptions 3 years ago versus today. And what you see is...
Sorry, John. John, can you index one page? Thank you.
It is a hit of about 90 basis points to the same mix. Now, Mikita conducts again these studies to model returns for asset classes yearly. Fortunately, there's a good amount of data. We want to make sure we are reasonable, so we compare to other consultants that put it, to other asset managers, other banks. There's actuary firms that conduct surveys and try to assimilate data. And we also have our on-track record, which I kind of skipped, section 3, that provides good reassurances that our models, while not perfect and no one's will be, are reasonable and prudent and fair to use. So to wrap up on the last slide, 141 will be, and we have already begun doing some work. We'll be having conversation with your staff first, then with investment advisory committee, then bring you materials for discussion and ultimate decisions and adoptions of asset mixes to the board. But it's important to keep the long term in mind. These projections change at least year over year, even if we look at where we are today versus just 2 months ago, the level of interest rates, at least on the long end of the curve, has moved up, you know, quite significantly. So again, any 1 year can have some implications into the future, but also, you know, this is a long-term fund, so it's important to not lose sight of that.
Sorry, John. So, I think we want to be on that summary slide, or what should you do, page 150.
Yes. And so the last observation today before I open it up to questions or comments from anybody else in the audience today, you know, is to be mindful, to have confidence that you know, setting up a good strategic asset allocation is prudent and it's the right thing to do, to rebalance where appropriate, and to not necessarily feel obligated to meet even target every day, every minute. After all, these are projections. They're very sensitive to the input. So while it's a good starting point, I think it's also very important to use common sense and to blend, you know, quantitative, you know, hard data with expertise and insights. And ultimately, these assets support the liability. So that's why this is very important in your current status. I went pretty fast. This is, again, as I mentioned, probably one of the most important decisions the board will consider this year as it relates to investments. So I'm happy to shave off time in the presentation of the performance, since at least in my opinion, this was more important than that. Thank you for your time. Any questions or comments, we welcome, and any feedback along the process too. We look forward to working on this item with you in the coming months.
What is your time frame, Leo, in terms of when you'll be bringing back your pretty completed project?
We will be having our first conversation with your investment staff here in the next coming days. So last night we finished our first draft, if you will. So sometime probably later today or definitely by tomorrow, we'll share that with your staff. They will review it. We will begin a set of conversations. Then it will go to the investment advisory committee. So next month, we could potentially be at a point where we might have something to share, at least some more insights, but I would imagine at least 2 months is probably more reasonable. So I would imagine in May we'll be at a much better place to have a conversation and go more in depth.
Okay, great. Thank you. Anybody else? Questions? If not, I guess we can go on to the fourth quarter report.
Sounds good, Bill. John, you'll be pleased to know I have the latest book, so you don't have to do the mental math. If you go to page 170, please. And I'm going to just hit two slides, guys, to hopefully save you some, earn you back some time. So this is an attribution chart explaining the sources of outperformance or underperformance in the fourth quarter. If you start at the bottom in the blue table, you can see the system generated a return of 5.6% in the quarter, but you know, pretty significantly below the benchmark return, which is in that 9.5 range. So you had about 4 percentage points of relative underperformance in the quarter. And the chart above explains the sources. So the theme is pretty similar to what we've been talking about today and many past meetings, is the impact of some of these legacy assets unfortunately negates some of the success of the public market or liquid assets. But how to read this chart? Green is the simplest. So green identifies if your active managers did better or worse than their benchmarks. So you want to see green to the right of that blue line. That means they're adding value. Green to the left means they're naturally underperformed their benchmark in the quarter. Blue is the allocation effect. So blue could mean if you're seeing less tails here, it means you were potentially underweight your target to an asset class that did very well in the quarter. So that's the situation with global equity and emerging market equity, both areas that had a tremendous rally in the fourth quarter. Or it's also, if you look down to real estate, you can see you had more real estate than your target, and real estate was not a good performer in that quarter, so it also shows a negative effect there. But if you want to summarize, the quarter, you trailed significantly because your private equity did not do as well as its benchmark, and you had too much real estate in a quarter when really everything else did well except for real estate. If you go to the next page, please. This shows the full calendar year, and I mean it's a really remarkable chart to see the drivers of underperformance there. So the green is Huff Energy. And frankly, you did have a tailwind in 2019 when there was a big write-up in Huff, but it fully reversed this year. The real estate down below is the same story, and interestingly, the blue bars for global equity and emerging market equity, frankly, were not as big of drivers of underperformance as, instinctively we may have would have thought. So naturally, in 2020 ended to be a great year for equities, so you would have been better off having more, but that really wasn't the main driver of your performance for the year. It really was the impact of Huff and then having a significant chunk in real estate in a year when you didn't really want it. But the rest of the portfolio consequentially is pretty much just right on that policy benchmark line. So performing fine, but just gets muted when you have these big extreme other factors at play. I'll wrap it up there. But field any questions if there are any.
No, I think that the only thing is that the other comment is, I mean, part of the equity underperformance was just the market was so skewed last year with five stocks dominating most of the returns, the FANG stocks. They were positive and the rest of the market was negative. So if you didn't own a lot of them, you were going to underperform, I would think.
Yeah, exactly. Very concentrated rally.
Okay. Any questions for Aaron? If not, I think, Kelly, we're okay to continue with the natural resources now. We're pretty close to being back on track. I appreciate Aaron and Lee doing that for us.
Yeah, I think we're doing fine on time.
And we'll, go ahead, Ryan.
Yeah, we're going to do the whole thing in closed session, so we need to move over there.
We going to the closed session then?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to move everybody out, the public out.